Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
This episode of The Dirty Inning contains information from the following sources. The August 18th, 1897 edition of the Buffalo Inquirer. October 1st, 1886 edition of the Philadelphia Inquirer. The May 2nd, 1883 edition of the Times of Philadelphia. The official website of the United States District Court for the District of Puerto Rico. And the good folks at the Philadelphia Connie Mack chapter of the Society for American Baseball Research. We couldn't have done this one without them. A podcast about still not nailing the timing.
Hello!
A podcast about baseball hopes, dreams, and the shattering of those hopes and dreams on the dirt of a crappy infield. Hello, listeners. I am Justin Clue, the head guy at The Good Fight, and with me is baseball prospectus contributor Dr. Trevor Strunk.
Hello, Justin.
Hello. Oh, see, that went really well.
That went great. We should do that more often.
I'm going to just copy and paste that exchange to the beginning of the podcast and just let it repeat, but that's okay. That's the quality we've come to give our listeners, and that's what they can expect from us. This is, of course, The Dirty Inning, a podcast that's a member of the Good Fight podcast family, but also the only podcast that I'm aware of in which two hosts discuss the most laughable, stupid, obscure, or awful innings in the history of Philadelphia Phillies baseball. And we may not always...
God, I hope there's not another one.
Oh, boy. I got some bad news for you, friend, because we tap into an infinite source of losing baseball games to find our material. And, boy, we tapped pretty deep into our source material for this episode.
I can't believe you found this one. When you told me about this, I was... Because I remember doing the 19... I previously held the record for the earliest... I'm going to give something away, but I previously held the record for earliest game. And I remember doing that and finding that, like, there was no information. Like, finding actual, like, information on this stuff was just so hard. So when you told me you were doing this, I was blown away.
I gotta tell you, yeah, no one wants to know this information. That should be very obvious. The kind of stuff we have, now, like, the reason records don't exist for those early games is because, A, you don't know where to find them, and B, who cares?
Like, yeah, it's true. You've never heard of any of the players. They all just, like, all of their ends are, and then they went and died in a trench.
And if you do manage to see a play-by-play, it's a lot of, like, he's out on an unknown play, out on an unknown play, you know, like that kind of stuff.
Because anyone actually doing any work on it was just like, I guess that's out, right? How does this game work?
You know, baseball games that were watched by three people, all of whom died within the next decade. Is it worth it in the end? And on this podcast, we say, unarguably, yes. Because today, ladies and gentlemen, we will not just be talking about an early game in the history of the Philadelphia Phillies. We will be talking about the first game in the history of the Philadelphia Phillies franchise, before they were even known as the Philadelphia Phillies. And there's a special little twinkle to this game that I was fully unaware of, but anyone probably would have guessed. And that was that in the very first game that is it's considered the first game in Phillies history, there was an altercation between the fans in the stands and the man umpiring the game.
Good.
Very unsurprised to learn. But, you know, Trev, before we even get to that, let's just, you know, plenty of umpires have been at odds with Philadelphia. This has happened many times throughout history.
Heard about this, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I remember one time in particular. I used to have a Sunday home game season ticket package for the Phillies, and our seats were in left field. And it was some game, I think it was against the Cubs, when somebody on the Cubs hit a ball that looked clearly foul from where everyone in the left field section was sitting. The umpire called it fair, gave it a home run. This was before replay had been implemented in any serious way, and it was just one of those very frustrating pre-replay moments where you were like, well, he made the call, and no matter how much they argue or play the game in protest, that's just not going to change. That's just the way it is.
That was a rough time. Like, even sort of like, I remember knowing that replay was the right thing because I thought about, like, well, how would I feel? Well, how will I feel when this impacts the Phillies in a bad way and, like, we lose a home run? Because, and I was just like, I'll still feel okay about it. I hate this feeling so much, and I don't even like when it comes in our favor, when it's like, oh, yeah, he wasn't safe. Well, who cares?
But I remember watching that. I remember, like, being, because, you know, when you're a younger fan with a lot of energy to expel, you can use that energy not on productive adult things, but on things like a wrong baseball call. And in this case, I ran down to the front row of our seats and started yelling to Pat Burrell about whether it was fair or foul. He just kind of, like, shrugged me off, like, I don't care, but we're not going to have, like, a thing here, an exchange or whatever. But I remember going home and looking up the name of the umpire, and it was Adrian Johnson, who is still, I believe, umpiring in Major League Baseball. And I don't know what
it wasn't Gene Steratore.
I don't know what I planned to do with that information. Clearly nothing. But I just wanted to know who he was and just be able to bring it up every time I saw his name, that he had wronged the Phillies in this way.
Were you planning on killing this guy?
I mean, I'm just saying, I learned his name. There's no, you know, there was no further database.
Yeah, okay, his address was a little harder to find. Fine. I mean, the name of his children.
I had to pay off a couple of people, and I skipped a couple of, an entire semester of college, something I called my opus, but you know, it turned into nothing. Adrian Johnson,
I have revenge fever.
still umpiring in baseball, and I'm sure we can remember other instances. I mean, Scott Barry and the Ryan Howard incident, where the first time Ryan Howard was ever ejected. I'm sure you remember that.
Yeah, that was a wild one.
That was a particularly anti-umpire moment in Philadelphia, and I actually remember one game I was at where an umpire was retiring at the end of the season, and they let him talk. They, like, gave him a microphone, and he was just, like, talking to the audience, because this is, like, the last time he was going to umpire in Philadelphia.
And they never did it again.
And after that, boy, did they regret that immediately. No, I got something to say to you people. No, he was actually very sweet, and he just talked about, like, Philadelphia. He appreciated how people in Philadelphia held you accountable for your calls, which
no
was interesting.
No one appreciates that.
Oh, this was all very much, I think, like, yeah, looking back. Nothing.
That's a lie.
He's like, I'm on my way out of here. I can say whatever I want. But he actually asked the audience to boo him after he was done. So he was like, give me one last Philly goodbye. Like, give me this a big raucous boo when I'm done talking. And we did. We gave him a huge boo, and it was kind of a funny, like, sweet little moment.
The real Philadelphia thing to do there would have been to cheer. So as to deny him the thing. Yay!
I mean, do you have a particular moment when you remember being inconsolably furious at an umpire?
The Scott Barry thing, yeah. I don't, you know, that's the one that I can think of as, like, a moment that I was actually mad at, like, specifically, historically. The moment that I remember being, like, truly furious is not, like, a specific one, but a brand of missed call, which is it angers me more than any football related or any other sports related problem or ref trying to think, injustice is the word I want to use. It is the mischecked swing. Ooh. I get so angry at checked swing problems. And then they'll show the replay, and I will unequivocally know whether a checked swing is like the least knowable thing in baseball. I will know. I will see it, and I'll say, that was a complete checked swing, or that was not a checked swing. This guy should be out. And I'll freak out and yell in my living room. Kristen has to tell me to stop yelling about checked swings.
I'm a strong believer in the idea that every time an umpire points down at first or third base to get a second opinion,
yes,
on a checked swing, that umpire down there has absolutely no idea. That every time they go either yes or no, they are just completely pulling it out of their ass, and they have absolutely no idea whatsoever. Like, half the time, these guys are probably, like, looking at something else, a piece of garbage that's blowing by. I mean, you can't tell me, because they get it wrong so
much. Oh, it's terrible. It is horrible.
Which I don't blame, though. A pair of human eyes is, it's going to be very difficult to detect where exactly a bat stopped. But that's what I mean when I say that's what makes me so sure that they're just making it up.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't even blame them for getting it wrong in that case. Like, yeah, okay, fine. Like, that's real hard. You're right. But, like, why do you get to pick?
why aren't I out there?
Why don't we just use a camera? What are we doing?
Yeah, but for all these reasons and more, booing umpires is, of course, a part of baseball. It's a very fun part of baseball. And
it rocks.
If you're an umpire, like, I get it. It's not fun to be a sponge for abuse. But most of the time, the abuse is purely verbal. And unless somebody is saying
warranted.
Right. And unless somebody is saying something, like, truly awful, most of the time we're just making noises with our mouths. Like, I feel like that's... It's all part of the game at this point. If you want to say the human element of an umpire screwing up is part of the game, then booing an umpire is certainly a part of a game. Because
that's
fans,
a good point.
It's one of the few things that we can do to feel like we're actually a part of the game. You know?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think you're right. Like, it's not, it's not fair to say, like, well, you know, these are just people, and that's how the game's played, and then say, like, but fans should be respectful. It's like, well, if you're gonna say one is naturally baseball, and the other is also, of course, naturally baseball.
And when you think about old baseball games, when people would, like, put on their fur coats or their brimmed caps and come on down to the ball yard, like, you imagine people sitting quietly and lightly applauding for plays and stuff. But as we are going to learn today, it took less than one single baseball game for that to be proven untrue, that even in 1883, audiences were not going to, they just weren't going to take an umpire's crap. They just weren't going to take it.
Awesome.
And they were not going to take it quite audibly. But like all verbal attacks in Philadelphia, there was a first one of this kind. And you'll be surprised to learn that, yes, as I said, it happened at the first game in Philadelphia Phillies franchise history. The target, Trev, was a man called Ogden.
Ogden Nash, famous poet.
In the original game recap, it just says the umpire, a man called Ogden. If you scroll down to the bottom of the box score, you see that his name was A.F. Ogden. And when you poke around baseball history for an idea of who this A.F. Ogden was, what made him tick, how he preferred his meat cooked, what sort of hideous avoidable disease took his life because he lived in the 1880s, here's what you'll find. Nothing. Nothing at all, because A.F. Ogden never existed. He's not a person. He's not real.
Wow.
He never donned his umpire's mask or tiny cap. He never hooted an out or safe call to the cheers or jeers of any worked-up 19th-century crowds high on caffeine or heroin. You can delve through the archives, Trev. You can telephone the official baseball umpires seminary built on the side of a mountain peak in the Adirondacks. You can find out that place doesn't exist by being told so repeatedly by the Applebee's employees you've called by mistake instead. You can email the research library in Cooperstown, Trev, but there's just no information to be had about A.F. Ogden. But on Arthur Fuller Odlin, Trev,
we
have much to learn.
Oh my goodness. You're telling me a newspaper got something wrong in the late 19th century?
This is why newspapers are going under, man. I gotta tell you. Just mistakes like this. It took the Connie Mack chapter of Sabre in Philadelphia and my friend Dennis, who I talked to about this, to inform us that thanks to a typo in the original game recap, I was chasing a ghost. Arthur Fuller Odlin was more than the first umpire hissed at in Philadelphia baseballdom that I learned once I had the appropriate name to chase. He's the son of Woodbridge Odlin and Abby Pratt, which Woodbridge as a first name. Tremendous. Tremendous.
Woodbridge Odlin sounds like some sort of, like, extremely, important gentleman. And mm-hmm. Abby Pratt sounds like a spunky ingenue.
If those are the ways we're casting these characters, I love that pairing. I ship Woodbridge and Abby, man.
It's good. It reminds me of that name is totally missing my mind. The famous story. The George Bernard Shaw play. Help me out. You're a big George Bernard Shaw, big Pygmalion. It's like Pygmalion.
I was going to say, I'm walking away from the microphone while you work this out. I'm going to make a sandwich, come back.
I came up with it.
I got there. Arthur Fuller Odlin, son of Woodbridge and Abby, husband to Mary Emma Allen, father to Lawrence and Evelyn, Dartmouth educated, Amherst educated.
Wow.
Odlin had shown a natural proclivity to umpiring, which we can only assume is just as awful as it sounds to see in your child. Woodbridge and Abby must have watched with growing concern as their little boy assigned outcomes to various events, with any challenges or questions on his rulings met by the pompous snare only a future umpire could evoke. Like realizing their child was showing like 4 to 6 signs of a future serial killer, only much, much more upsetting. As his schoolyard chum...
he was torturing animals.
As his schoolyard chums went about their stick balls and foot races and peach basket hullabaloos and war flashbacks and other playground games of the 1880s, such as Miner's Cough, Kick the Canary, Blood in the Stool, Odlin was probably racing into their midst, announcing the results of plays, arguing with his more vocal or confused peers, and fleeing the playground or vacant lot following a game's conclusion, refusing to answer any questions regarding his decisions. But it was this natural officiating instinct that sent him onto the college circuit, where he was, in fact, umpiring at a young age, and was spotted by the eye of C.R. Webster, president of the American College Baseball Association, who informed the National League of Major League Baseball that in Odlin, he had found a real umpiring stud who was ready to move up to the next level. Which, in an umpire, what are you looking for, really, when you're scouting umpires?
I don't know, firmness, I guess. Like, you can't... you want someone who's going to stick by their decision no matter how much an angry, red-faced man yells at them. Like, that would be my fatal flaw. I think I'd probably, if an angry red-faced man yelled at me, I'd just do what he said.
I had a friend once who told me about his workplace where, like, they had all these problems, but all of the problems could be solved by people, like, communicating better. And he said, some people think that the worst thing that can happen is an argument. And that's, that's very common. People's fear of confrontation.
People
like,
hate arguments.
That holds up so many forms of progress, big and small. And an umpire, it's got to be like constant confrontation. It's that thing you're always trying to avoid, but it's a job and it's close to the only part of it, you know? Like someone is always going to be unhappy about a call. Even if it's the right one, someone is always going to be unhappy about what you say.
Probably like a good umpire, like you look for the same thing in an umpire as you do, and this is, you know, this sounds cliched and probably is, but you probably look for the same thing you'd look for if you were like trying to find someone who would make a good cop. Like you're just like, well, they love rules. They love order, and they love imposing those rules and order on others. And if they don't love it, then they see some sort of... maybe even better, they don't like it. They have a pathological need to do it.
That's a really good point, because it's been compared over the years that certain umpires who have those sort of qualities to an unpleasant degree... see themselves as, and Joe West in particular, as like a sheriff of baseball.
Oh yeah, Sheriff Joe West. Yeah, exactly. And that explains their pompousness too, where it's like, oh yeah, well, if I wasn't here, this would all just be chaos. You'd all be hitting balls anywhere you wanted, and everyone would say they got a home run, and no one would know.
Exactly. And yeah, the idea that not only am I doing this job better than anyone, but no one else could even do what I do. Like, this is... I'm doing you a favor by being here. You just don't realize it.
Do you think they have, like, a... like, you know how, like, cops will do the thin blue line? Like, do you think umpires have one of those?
Are you talking about, like, the...
The flag, for sure. I mean, I'm sure they just... most of them just have the cop flag. But, like, I'm thinking, like, you know, like, cops will say, like, it's us versus them. It's the thin blue line, and that's where that flag comes from.
Right. I was thinking of the, you mean like the curtain, basically, where it's like a policeman, you know, they aren't going to turn on other policemen. And I think that unarguably exists with umpires.
Well, that's true. But also, the way that works, I was more, well, yes, that's definitely true. And you should talk about that. But I wanted to clarify before we got off, like, the concept that, like, you know, there's a thing separating us from total chaos, and it's a thin blue line, and I'm the thin blue line between us and just total panic and total chaos and just a world full of monstrousness. You think they have like a color that they assign to themselves?
Well, it is blue, isn't it? That's what you call an umpire, blue. Like, that's...
oh yeah, so then maybe they're the thin blue line too.
I think comparisons like it's a pretty apt comparison given like different contexts. It still totally works. But yeah, I mean, and I've talked on other podcasts about how confusing the very serious veil of silence that umpires get to live behind. Like, that is, it's confusing. Like, okay, I get some like professions need that level of like secrecy.
Yeah, you're not
but,
a priest, dude.
But an umpire, like a baseball umpire, you're purely on the leisure side of like the professional circuit here. Like, what do you have to hide? What's going on?
If you saw half the things I saw as a professional major league umpire.
Well, according to the Major League Baseball director of umpire administration, Tom Leppard, he says
in a leopard,
according to a leopard with a tiny hat on, confidence, a strong presence on the field, knowledge of the mechanics, where to go when the ball is hit, forceful calls, good use of voice, hustle, and ability to handle situations on the field are all important.
I believe hustle is probably one of the lesser important ones.
given
things like Joe West.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I don't see a lot of these guys being in tip-top shape.
Angel Hernandez is constantly hustling. That's what we know about him.
Yeah, you know, I don't like anything of like that, his calls or his style or his strike zone, but man, he knows how to get to the plate. He knows where home plate is.
Classic hustler and ref, David Eckstein, everyone.
former minor league baseball umpire development director Mike Fitzpatrick said, good judgment and character are things instructors look for as well. Hold on, don't laugh until I'm done. That's very, very important because we're entrusting the integrity of the game to the umpire. So we're looking for the highest quality type of individual that we can possibly recruit, Fitzpatrick said. The whole integrity of the game rests with the umpire out there on the field. Think about the things you've seen umpires do, Trev, and ask yourself.
Truly an insane position to take.
Were those the actions of someone you consider a pillar of integrity and sound judgment? Because I got to tell you, I see Scott Barry's face mocking Ryan Howard in that game, and I got to tell you, I don't feel like that was very, there was a lot of integrity in that moment.
No. How many times have you seen refs, and this is true of, you know, like, I think in football, when I get mad at refs, I think what you've done here is you just want to impact the outcome of the game, or like, you favor this player or team over that player or team, and that's why you did that. Like, that's why Tom Brady just got a roughing the passer penalty when he shouldn't have gotten it, or whatever. Like, right or wrong, that's what you think of. But like, in baseball, it's always like, you want to be the star of the show right now. Like, you are mad that people are not watching the game for the players and not you, and you want to be the star of the show, so you've done something here, and that is grotesque. And that is what I think of, and what everyone thinks of when they're mad at an umpire. So I don't get, like, what. There has never been someone I've met who's been like, yep, the integrity of the umpires is the only thing keeping this whole sport from just going completely off the rails.
I would say that, yeah, no, I totally agree. But I would say that back when this, you know, in this era, the 1883 era of umpires, the things that our two umpire professionals that I quoted here are saying were probably much more true. And obviously, you know, not even just baseball, but society has evolved quite a bit since then. And now, you know, umpires sort of have this, like, there was a point where it was like, yeah, umpires and managers are like classic enemies, like dogs and cats, but they respect each other kind of thing. And you have kind of like looser umpires who are more liked by players. And I don't know. I think back then it was really, they were probably closer to like priests. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Because they were supposed to be part of the field, which is what everyone says, that the umpire is part of the field.
Right.
And that we know any of the umpires' names now would be reprehensible, I feel like, to guys like Odlin, who are coming up at a point where it was like, this is, you know, the reverence of baseball. These are the rules, and we follow them, or the whole game falls apart.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it explains, you know, we were making fun of it, but like, the typo is actually sort of telling of that, where it's like, oh yeah, like, no one's going to misspell Joe West's name. Not because it's an easy name, necessarily, just obviously that's part of it, but like, you know, no one's going to misspell it because Joe West is everywhere. Like, oh, it's Cowboy Joe West. He has a country album he's trying to sell. Like, that's crazy if you take it from, like, umpires are part of the field. No, like, we all know who the umpires are, and we know if they're going to be fair to our team or not. Already, yeah. When the game starts.
And it sucks. It sucks that we know that. It sucks that we know Joe West's name. It sucks that we know his nickname. It sucks that we know he's dreamed about having a country music career his whole umpiring career. It sucks. I don't care about that.
And didn't he succeed? Isn't he hosting the CMT Awards this year?
I mean, he has like an album. I don't know how successful he has been. But in any case, Joe West was not the umpire everyone hated at least one Phillies game. We know. So Arthur Fuller Odlin was ready to take on the mantle of umpire at the Phillies' first ever baseball game. And he was embodying those things when his boss passed his name on to the major league level. And from that point on, everything went really well forever.
Uh-oh.
False! Odlin had graduated to the major leagues in the spring of 1883, which, if you are counting along at home, means that, yes, Odlin was a first-time big league umpire at exactly the dawn of the Phillies, which is to say, the Quakers. The Phillies were not yet themselves, but this game on May 1st, 1883 at Recreation Park in Philadelphia is considered to be the first ever game of the Philadelphia Phillies franchise, and it was umpired by none other than A.F. Odlin.
No!
Odlin was about to learn just how we were going to do baseball in this town in the centuries to follow.
Oh, I eat watermelon and I have 4 years, sing polly wally doodle all day. I like watermelon, but it wets my ears, sing polly wally doodle all day. Baby grass tastes good to a moo cow's mouth, sing polly wally doodle all day. But I like chicken cause I'm from the south, sing polly wally doodle all day. Farewell, Mr. Gloom, be on your way. If you think you're gonna worry, you can stop it in a hurry, sing polly wally doodle all day.
Yes, Trev, 1883 was quite a year for music. That was a 1935 rendition of the 1883 hit Polly Wally Doodle All Day, born at a time when Americans were so stuffy and repressed, they could communicate at times solely in nonsense words. The pop music industry was afire with hits like Polly Wally Doodle All Day, There Is a Tavern in the Town, and The Transit of Venus March by tabloid darling J. Philip Sousa. But music wasn't the only thing blowing up in 1883.
A nightmare. What else exploded, Justin?
I'm glad you asked. In late August of this year, the Dutch East Indies bore witness to the most deadly volcanic eruption when the island of Krakatoa and its surrounding archipelago were decimated and sunk into the ocean. Over 36,000 people were killed from the event and the resulting tsunamis. The force of the blast was 4 times as strong as the most powerful nuclear weapon ever detonated on this planet.
Hmm. Seems pretty strong.
But in Philadelphia, it was a lack of power that dominated the spring.
Boo!
Welcome to 1880s Philadelphia, Trev. Listen to the honk of steamerships. Listen to the honk of steamerships as they arrive twice a week in Philadelphia from their 8-day journey from Germany. why not take in a show at one of our new local theaters, do some shopping in a recently opened department store, or take out a book from a new local library on the symptoms of yellow fever, a terrifying epidemic of which took hold of this city only 10 years ago. Hmm. Perhaps take a train out to the quickly rising Main Line, a series of suburban communities housing the rich and entitled for decades to come. Marvel at our horizontal steam engine, the symbol of our progress as a city of manufacturers. But again, please mention if you suddenly are experiencing headaches, nausea, delirium, or if your skin and eyes turn a pale, sickly yellow. It's nothing to worry about, I promise. We'll just ask the train to make a bonus stop at a sanitarium where you can spend several weeks or years being probably dead. But elsewhere, the leisures of our fair city have only begun to expand. Have you heard of this baseball everyone is talking about?
No.
We've got a local nine now, too. We didn't name our team after a certain color of stocking, like some other lame cities.
Every other city has done this at this point. The Boston Red Stockings, the Chicago White Stockings, the Milwaukee Green Stockings.
Cincinnati Red Stockings. I believe there was a blue stocking somewhere, but...
Terrible convention.
Our boys are called the Quakers, after our region's most quiet, unintimidating religious faction. The Quakers would finish with only 17 wins in 1883. No other team in baseball would have fewer than 40. The Quakers scored 437 runs, allowing almost 900, which is extremely the worst.
Yeah, that's terrible. Wow. Good gravy.
They were very bad. And it became evident very, very immediately that we may need to rethink the whole baseball in Philadelphia thing. Not across town, mind you, where the Athletics would end the year in first place in the American Association. Mm-hmm. But at Recreation Park, things were just getting started. And not only would the Quakers kick things off with a gut-wrenching loss, but an umpire. An umpire would take less than 9 innings to earn the hatred of the audience.
There is a tavern in the town, and there my true love sits him down, and drinks his wine as merry as can be, and never, never thinks of me. Fare thee well, for I must leave thee, do not let the parting grieve thee. All the time has come for you and I to say goodbye, adieu. Adieu, kind friends, adieu.
Yes, adieu.
I can no longer stay with you.
Stay with you.
Oh, I'll hang my heart on a weeping willow tree. Fare thee well, fare thee well, fare thee well.
Our inning today takes place in the 8th inning of May 1st, 1883. The Philadelphia Quakers and Providence Grays were opening the season at Recreation Park in Philadelphia in front of a crowd of 1,200 people. Blondie Purcell and Bill McClellan had keyed the Quakers' 3-0 lead, which they had held until the events of this 8th inning. Whew. So, the Grays' old hoss Radbourne started the trouble. That's right. Thought you'd like that.
My friend!
which is to say, he was at bat when Odlin continued calling strikes balls, according to the newspaper account, which was...
Another extremely important element of a promising ref.
I gotta tell you, this game recap was far more of an editorial than a game recap that you would read today.
Game recaps should be.
I mean, you know, it was more interesting and more fun to read because there was like an opinion put in there. Like the way this would be written today would be like, several close pitches led to an argument between, you know, the manager and the umpire. In this case, they were just like, he threw 4 pitches down the middle of the plate and the umpire awarded him first base anyway. Like,
I think my least favorite, recent sports writing convention is, the Philadelphia convention of the, no, just kidding, is the, is
awful.
The, yeah, sorry, is the convention of, saying like the Philadelphia fans did not appreciate when, or like the such and such fans were not pleased when, instead of saying like, you know, the umpire had some close calls, you like passive voice it onto the fans. Like,
yeah.
The fans didn't like it when this happened.
I was really? Merely Are you an kidding observer. Me? And had no strong feelings either way. It's me, the human embodiment of objectivity.
Right, exactly. Or it's even worse than that. It's like not just the human embodiment of objectivity, but like somehow they've overcome the idea of objectivity or never understood it in the first place. So, like, it's like this version of like a robot who's like, I have viewed these strange human creatures.
Yeah,
some of the various natives seem to disagree with the umpire. It's like, you know what's going on here.
It's such a point of pride for some writers to point out that, like, I'm not rooting for either team. I'm just, you know, I remain objective. There's no clapping in the press box. Like, okay, great. You definitely feel some sort of way. You haven't, like, transcended to the next level of humanity where you're just, like, the observers floating above humanity writing these completely objective, emotionless accounts. Like, I get why that exists. You don't want bias in a report, I suppose, but in sports, I would say that it probably matters much less than in like a political story. You know what I mean?
Well, like, I remember someone saying, when you become, you know, careful what you wish for. You might not want to be a sports writer if you love sports because you can't even enjoy your favorite team anymore because you have to be objective. I remember thinking that, I was like, wow, that's amazing. Like, what a weird, like, what a weird sacrifice to have to make to, like, have to not root for your favorite team anymore. And then, of course, like, I was just thinking, that was the stupidest thing to believe in the world. Like, of course they root for their favorite team still. They just don't do it in the article.
I mean, it's not that hard to not. Like, The Good Fight is a fan site, but the idea that that somehow provides a blinding level of bias has always seemed kind of silly to me. Obviously, there's going to be a bias towards the Phillies because it is a Philadelphia Phillies fan site. However, nothing has ever stopped any of the Good Fight's writers from criticizing the Phillies severely when they have done things that are worth criticizing. And we've had people with differing opinions on whether something was worth being criticized or not. And those opinions have all appeared on the site. Like, as though fandom forces you to put on blinders or you wouldn't be able to speak to a certain person because you were a fan of them. I don't know. I get it. I do understand why it's an initial concept, but it's become far less of an issue to me over the years since we've been doing this.
Well, yeah, and it's also, and we should get to the game because we're going to go way over. But you know, it's also this, like, it's this version of the world where, oh, sorry, you got drafted into following this team, or, you know, you got drafted into the objectivity core of the umpires. You can never have an opinion, and again, I'm sorry. You have to give it up. Like, you're a Green Lantern or something. Like, I'm sorry, but Green Lanterns cannot have attachments of the human sort. Like, you'll have to give up your girlfriend, Hal Jordan. Like, it's not that important. Like, you're covering the Seahawks now. It doesn't mean that you can't root for the Eagles. It just means you can't write articles about it or tweet about it.
Yeah, bummer. I'm sure you'll be able to work that out.
Yeah.
Well, in any case, like I said, these were far more colorful accounts of this baseball game from 1883.
And good.
and fun to read. And Odlin had also made some questionable ball strike calls the previous inning that had started the audience's sort of annoyance at him because it had allowed a runner for the Grays to reach base, but then that guy got out at second, so it wound up not being that big of a deal. But it sort of started their distrust of his calls. So old Hoss Radbourne, like I said, he starts the trouble in the eighth. Odlin wouldn't be so lucky this time because during the Radbourne at bat, the Times of Philadelphia would have you believe that Radbourne should have been called out on strikes only for him to be awarded first base. And this naturally caused the fans to, quote, hiss the umpire vigorously.
Bunch of cats in the audience.
This was followed by three singles and a double, giving the Grays a 4-3 lead late, which is everybody's favorite thing in Philadelphia. Losing a lead in the eighth because of an umpire's missed call.
Oh my god, in the first game ever.
First game ever.
And they went on to have a bad season. This is like fever dreams of 2014 right here.
So it gets even worse. So the Quakers had some time to take the lead back, and to do so they had outfielder Blondie Purcell, who would hit .268 for Philadelphia, the second highest batting average on the team over 97 games.
Ugh.
Purcell was known for being a guy who was a little, I mean, the rules were more like options to him. He had started a fight in a game as a member of the Boston Bean, or he would go on to start a fight in a game as a member of the Boston Bean Eaters in 1885. When it was,
if you call a Bostonian that now, they think it's a racial slur.
Oh, really?
No, but I'm just making fun of Boston.
He was very into cutting the ball with his spikes, which deadened it even more severely. This cheating reputation persisted throughout his career due to him cheating all the time.
Yeah, there was one of those things that'll dog you if you just end up cheating a lot.
There was a play where he was on Boston. I believe it was his first game with Boston. He wound up getting fined $50 for this. But there was a foul ball hit towards him in the outfield, and he went to get it. And people noticed that he was kind of slow to get it into the infield, but nobody really thought anything about it. And then the next two batters both grounded out on, like, really painfully dead ground balls. And suddenly someone was like, what's
check the ball
on? So they check the ball, they see it's just been like decimated by a cleat, and there was, according to the Buffalo Inquirer at the time, when it was seen there was an awful row, and Blondie's slowness in fielding the foul in from left was remembered, and the ex-Syracuse star was called to account by the umpire. He, of awesome. Course, was like, "Oh, I didn't do anything." It says he declared his innocence in tones that would seem to show that he was highly insulted, and he might have got away with his bluff had not the umpire caught a glimpse of the outlines of a large-sized pocket knife in his pocket.
Oh, I have never been so insulted in all of my life. I'm getting someone's gonna hear about this.
Oh, this is my baseball knife. I carry this with me everywhere.
Why did I get in there? Hey, boy.
What if there's a fight and I need to stab somebody on the field? Do you think about that?
Young Ty Cobb is just watching and nodding. That's right.
Well, not only is he known for these types of incidents, but in 1886, he was actually attended the Grand Opera in St. Louis, I believe it
Different
was.
Different times.
Yeah, in 1886, he and some teammates went down to the old opera, and they got balcony seats, so like not the best seats. And the first act of the opera happened, an intermission started, and all the players like left to go stretch their legs, and then they all went back to their balcony seats afterwards. And this is from a version of this. I believe this was like a national equivalent of an AP generated story, but I'm reading this from the Atlanta Constitution in 1886. AJC. So when they all got back from doing that, Purcell, seeing a boy at the door of the dress circle, forced himself in and took a seat. And when the regular doorkeeper returned to his post of duty, which was only a minute or two later, Purcell was pointed out to him as a man that belonged in the balcony. The doorkeeper went to Purcell in a nice, gentlemanly manner and asked him to please go upstairs where he belonged. Purcell refused to budge out of his seat, and when told that he would be forcibly ejected, he remarked that it would take just four men to put him out. The bouncer at the Grand Opera House is a pretty healthy specimen, and when the fair-haired left fielder refused to vacate, the bouncer took him by the collar and tore him, together with the seat, loose and carried him out by the neck.
Awesome.
Bystanders say that Purcell's tongue was hanging so far out that they thought he had on a red necktie.
I like Purcell's like extremely boastful but ultimately modest boast. Like, oh well, or a promise, like it'll take four men to me leave.
Looking around, like about to say eight, but then he sees how big they are, and he's like, four. We'll go with four.
Yeah, no, probably four if you could do it. If I'm being honest, four people, four guys.
Well, Purcell would also go on to do quite well at the head of a bookmaking venture after his playing career. So,
bookmaking in the legal or illegal sense?
Oh, what do you think? Oh, definitely no. As short, like as the long term for bookie sense.
Yeah, not so he didn't start Knopf.
This is not an acclaimed publisher we're talking about, no.
I can't believe he started Doubleday. That's cool.
Today, on May 1st, 1883, when the Quakers needed him most, he was nursing a leg he had wrenched badly running to first base in the sixth inning. The Providence captain, who apparently got to make these kinds of decisions, didn't let the Quakers sub in a runner for Purcell after he laced an extra, he hit an extra base hit in the bottom of the eighth. But since he, quote, almost walked to first base because of his knee, he could only get to first base.
Seems cool that the opposing captain can decide that.
Yeah. Are you going to let somebody run for him? No. Damn it.
I'm not. No. You guys got to, you're on your own.
That seems like it would be bad for me and my team. So the other big offensive powerhouse for Philadelphia on the day, Bill McClellan, he came up next, fired a ground ball through first base that would have been really beneficial if a man with a backwards knee hadn't been hobbling to second base. So now they're runners on first and second. Probably a run should have scored by now, but you know, two extra base hits probably means the Quakers would have gone up by a run. But no, Purcell was just kind of walking around out there.
It's a real shame they made him play on his torn ACL, but you know, different times. They were tougher back then.
So Purcell was likely overjoyed when a pitch skipped past the Providence catcher, meaning like he was expecting to run to the next base, even though he's like, God damn it. So we can only assume he army crawled to third base. And by the official account and fan opinion, Purcell was easily safe. But A.F. Odlin didn't see it that way. He called Purcell out, which the Times called a, quote, most flagrant decision, which the audience promptly resented by hooting him. The Quakers, Fred Lewis. You know, that Philadelphia sound we make.
Oh, man, that classic sound. Everyone knows what it means when you get hooted at Philadelphia games.
Slapping our arms like Craig Kimbrell, just, you know, trying to be as intimidating and making ourselves as big as possible.
It's how we deal with umpires and wild cats. Big cats. Make yourself big.
Both of which are epidemics in Philadelphia, yes. The Quakers' Fred Lewis then slapped a grounder past third base on a close play at first that could have kept the game alive, and did for one moment, as Odlin called him safe.
Oh, yeah.
Until he, quote, almost immediately changed his decision and gave the runner out.
Amazing.
And this is the last line of the game recap. Then there was some more hooting.
Hoot.
That's the entire recap, which I felt like that was such a good line to go out on because
it's
just kind of
set
up
good.
The future of Philadelphia baseball. So the Quakers lost 4-3, setting off a series of franchise losses that is still the highest amount of numbered sucking that a sports franchise has ever done professionally.
Give us that number again, my friend.
I don't remember. It's way past the 10,000 losses for which
a bajillion
became notorious not too long ago. But I mean, God, that was probably over 10 years ago now, right? Right before the.
It wasn't before the World Series, I don't think.
I think it was. I think it was before any of that success from that 07-11.
I think so.
Yeah, it was July 16th, 2007.
Oh,
Philly's
wow,
first
really?
Professional team to 10,000 losses from the
Wow, Olympics. That long ago. That's unbelievable. I
Over
really
10 years ago. So.
Wow, I really thought it was more recent than that. That's
well,
wild.
Let's check. This has to be very easy information to find. So we'll Philly's official win-loss record of all time is 9,744 to 10,919.
We're getting up to 500, everyone. It's just going to take us a couple more decades.
God, so close. We're so close. And, you know, two World Series championships in there, too, to mix things up. But
that's right.
Yes, this was the first of 10,919 losses currently, thanks in large part to the umpire. As the Times wrote, quote, the umpiring of a man named Ogden, one of the newly appointed umpires who comes from somewhere in New Hampshire where the people do not know the difference between baseball and football,
and
the discourtesy of the visitors in the latter part of the game, robbed the Philadelphia Nine of the victory. I assume that's referencing not just that they took the lead late, but also
that they didn't let, yeah, that would make sense that like they were, that they got kind of hooted.
So my theory was this, then, that because the Quakers audience was very raw at this point, they sort of learned what, like, the rules were in this moment and saw that a team was discourteous to them. So they thought, okay, well, the only way to protect ourselves is to be discourteous right back to the opposing teams and umpires who we don't like. And perhaps that planted the seed of the origins of Philadelphia baseball fandom, the reputation of which is well known today.
I like it. It's either that or the, and I maybe a little bit of both, the whole like, well, if they think I'm a monster, then I'll become a monster.
that's exactly what I'm talking about. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think there's some credit. There's some credibility to that. Absolutely. It's not our fault. Baseball made us this way, which I think anyone would tell you.
They'd all agree. No, it's exactly correct.
Well, Trev, the trouble didn't end for old Arthur Fuller Odlin after this game.
No!
This same month of May, just weeks later, from the 14th to the 17th, he umpired a series in Detroit that actually saw the Phillies taking on the Wolverines, who were playing there at that time.
Michigan Wolverines?
The Detroit Wolverines.
Okay. It was like the college team?
And during that series, Odlin's calls so infuriated Detroit owner W.G. Thompson that Thompson demanded that he be stripped of his duties for incompetency, which I think we all know is not something umpires living in a world with Joe West or Angel Hernandez or C.B. Buckner need to worry about
anymore. Yeah, they're all really good now.
Just the best of the best out there, and that's the only way it's ever going to be.
Was he?
Who?
Was he stripped of his powers?
Well, in 1883, it was fully possible for that to happen, as Thompson had had another umpire kicked out of baseball the previous season for similar reasons. And indeed, Odlin showed up in Chicago for his next assignment on May 22nd to umpire another series, only to find a telegram waiting for him from the National League secretary telling him to get the hell out of baseball. But get this, like a pro...
Did it actually say that?
No.
Oh.
like a pro... He umpired the game he was there to umpire anyway, because the league hadn't had the foresight to send a replacement, though they had remembered to fire him.
Wow.
So he goes out there after being fired by telegram, which is like being fired by email.
That is, yeah, it's extremely cruel.
And still did his job. I hope he got paid, because that's, you know.
He definitely didn't get paid.
Props, bro.
He 100% was not paid for that.
Chicago American Sports wrote that there was no reason for such dramatic action to be taken, defending Odlin's credibility. But Sporting Life went the other way with it, saying that no, Odlin was actually terrible and sucked.
Sporting Life, but published only in Detroit and Philadelphia.
But you know who agreed with them or disagreed with them? The Ohio, Florida, and Massachusetts state bars, where Fuller Odlin went on to practice law after his umpiring career.
Ah, so he became a real umpire.
By 1921, President Warren Harding made Arthur Fuller Odlin the 8th appointed U.S. district judge in Puerto Rico, where he oversaw the first case of police corruption on the island.
And found in favor of the police.
And that is, the way he ended up. He wound up, he left office in 1925 and passed away on June 5th, 1926 in Jacksonville, Florida. He gave that Puerto Rico job his all. He learned Spanish. I believe he started on a lower level position and then worked his way up higher than he'd been assigned. I mean, I don't know. I got to tell you, after learning this whole story and after the people at the Connie Mack chapter of Saber helped me out, pointed me in the right direction with the right name and some anecdotes about Odlin's historical career.
Amazing how much research you do for this podcast, Justin. I just want to tell you.
I just want to say that, I don't know, in my opinion, and we can talk about this, Odlin didn't seem like he was too bad of an umpire. And I realized that, one thing he definitely did wrong was reversing a call after making a call.
Yeah, that's not great.
I am a grown-ass person who has played in several intramural sports leagues, and I've never the kind of person who, you know, gives a referee or an official in any of those games crap, because the people that do that on a regular basis suck. Like, if you're really going after somebody who's getting paid $20 to spend their evening umpiring an adult kickball game, like, come on, get your head out of your ass. But there was one time where I was unable to stop myself from shouting at an umpire who made a call and then reversed the call because the other team didn't like it.
Yeah, the reversal of calls, late flags, that's the worst stuff, man. That is late calls. I don't like those either, where it's like they wait a second and then see how mad the people are and then call it out or safe.
Yes, which I think that is, yeah, one of the cardinal sins of officiating. However, we're talking about a guy who is young, probably very young for an umpire, who was already getting taunted by the crowd, who probably could hear every one of the, like, personal insults or hisses coming down extremely intimidating hooting sounds coming from the audience, who was probably, you know, at least a little nervous or self-conscious after, like, getting called out for making wrong calls. And, like, in a moment, maybe he just said the call. He just said the wrong one by accident when he had meant to say the other one. So I don't know. I want to give this guy credit because clearly he was good enough for the, like, head of umpiring to be like, this guy is pretty good. Get him in there. And good enough that another publication would back him. And good enough that, like, he was a wunderkind of umpires. So I think the odds were against you to be considered a good umpire back in the day. He didn't have the advantage of having any technology. He didn't have any backup. He didn't have any other umpires out there to, like, defend him.
Yeah, he was the sole umpire, right?
And that was something I've read that umpires also, you know, when you're out there, it's you and the other umpire, and that's kind of it. Like, at times it can be the two of you versus everybody else, and if there's not another guy for you to be, you know, with against everyone else, that's probably a very intimidating prospect, especially at an age where, like, that game recap could have easily read, and then some fans beat up the umpire and went home and, like,
and nothing, he died,
you know, there was no accountability. Like, oh, okay, they got fined $20 for assault and battery and then went home to their families, like.
Yeah, I don't think he sounds that bad. I don't like the reversed call is bad, but that's, like, to me, the one thing that sort of suggests is that maybe he was, I don't know, like, maybe that was a yips moment that he needed to get over and didn't, where, like, I feel like if you do that, it's sort of like, I'm trying to think of a good example. I keep thinking of Don Brown, but I can't think of an example of when he went bad. Like, he just was sort of, he sort of had an unfortunate career. I don't know, like, any player who, like, is amazing, and then, well, Shelby Miller is a good example. Like, Shelby Miller was so good at pitching. I'm not thinking of Shelby Miller. I'm thinking of...
Oh, is this the guy that you love who wound up getting, like, foot and mouth disease or something?
I don't know who that is, but no. no, this is the guy, Rick Ankiel, oh, okay. Was such a good pitcher, and then, like, he changed one thing or got hurt, and then he wasn't a good pitcher anymore. And I think, like, it's different, because, of course, Ogland wasn't hurt, and it's different than pitching, because it's not the same kind of physical activity. There's way fewer variables. But, like, it feels like that, where you're kind of looking at it and you're like, okay, I did something really bad. This is the point where I'm either going to turn it around and rely on my natural talent again, or it's going to all go bad. Or maybe I will rely on my natural talent and no one will ever forgive me. And it feels like that's kind of what happened to him, where it was like, well, yeah, you could be as good as you wanted to at this point, but now the die's been cast. Like, you made this one bad move and no one's going to forgive you for it.
First impressions are everything. You can't, you know, Trev, as they say, you only get one chance to make a first impression.
I heard it was two.
With the hooting throngs of Philadelphia sports fandom.
Come on, one more time. Let me that fine Philadelphia greeting.
Ah, yes. This is that painfully normal situation I found myself
wonderful.
In.
Wonderful.
Now, by decree of the U.S. District Judge of Puerto Rico, you're all under arrest.
I'm glad I didn't, because he ended up being sort of a good district attorney, but when you said that, I immediately thought, and he declared someone guilty of a crime until they were innocent 1 minute later.
Well, in any case, that was the first game in Philadelphia franchise history. It was, of course, turmoil with the fans, with the other team, with the umpire. But yes, that is the kind of story you can come to expect from the Dirty Inning, of which we have future episodes lined up that you're really going to enjoy. So if you liked this one, you're going to certainly just fall in love with the stories we tell you in the near future. And of course, Don't forget to download, subscribe, and comment on the other podcasts who are part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hit and Season with John Stolness and Continued Success with myself and Liz Rusher. So we are doing, I would say, an unbiased, tremendous job with keeping you up to date with Phillies news and breaking news, what little of it there is, but also just entertainment and commentary. If you are starved for Phillies content right now, I'm telling you, there's no reason to be, because this is a perfectly fulfilling set of Phillies podcasts ready to be inside your ears. So thank you for listening to The Dirty Inning, and we will have another absolutely terrible story to get to tell you on our next episode.
I hope someone dies of a plague in the next episode.
Tune in next time where everyone dies. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on The Dirty Inning.
Thanks, everyone. Talk to you soon.
Hey everybody, how you doing? Well, that's good. My name is Bill Matz. I am the director of Fun and Games for Broad Street Hockey Radio Podcasts.
And I am Kelly, the deputy managing editor of BroadStreetHockey.com.
I'm Steph Driver, the NHL editorial manager for SB Nation.
And I am Charlie O'Connor, lead Flyers writer for TheAthletic.com.
And together we make up BSH Radio, one of the shows that you get at the SB Nation podcast family. We have a lot coming to you this year, and we want you to listen to our show. It is just an all Flyers, all the time show, so much content. I really hope you listen to it. It is a great piece of the SB Nation podcast family, along with all your other favorite sports.
We all love hockey, specifically the Flyers.
Let's go the Flyers.
The hockey team, the Flyers.